I'm speaking with Miles Mosley. We're in Telluride. He's going to be playing at the Telluride Jazz Festival later this afternoon. So you're considered one of the world's premier upright bassists, and you've been called the Jimi Hendrix of the upright bass. Can you tell me a little bit about how you chose this instrument and what style of music you started off playing? And then I'm curious, too, as to when you started to get more experimental with it and do something that had not been done before.
Well, I started playing in junior high school on accident, because just as the bass is sitting in the corner here in this room, I signed up for like a comic book drawing class, but there weren't enough kids in it. So they said you can go to art history or you can go to orchestra. And the whole point of me taking the comic book drawing class was because I was certain that, like, you couldn't tell if I was being lazy or if I just sucked at it and was trying really hard. So you'd probably get an A no matter what. So I was looking for an easy A. So I went to the orchestra, and I didn't know what I wanted to play, and all the kids did. And I lived kind of far away from my school, so I had to take a bus and walk. And so the teacher played the options for me, violin, viola, and cello. And I loved the cello, and she said, great, I'll assign you one, and you can take it home. And I was like, if I take this cello on a bus and then walk with it and schlep it all around, it's gonna suck. So I saw the bass in the corner, and I was like, what's that? She said, it's upright bass. I was like, dang, you got to take that home with you every day? She said, no, if you pick the upright bass, it stays here. I said, great, you now have yourself one upright bass player. So I picked it out of pure laziness, but when I got it, when I touched it for the first time, I fell in love with it, and I was really good at all the hard parts. So that helped with the laziness, because I was just naturally kind of started at 60%, which allowed me to garner the attention of a lot of great teachers like John Clayton and Al McKibben and Ray Brown. And so that's how I started, and I started classically. And then I started studying jazz, because my parents love jazz so much. And then I developed that throughout school and was really kind of focused on the jazz side of things. And then I guess, you know, at some point in time, when the bass solos, everyone stops playing and it gets really quiet because the bass is a really soft instrument. And that sucks, because I just finished giving all this energy and love and support behind the sax solo and the trumpet solo. But then it's my solo when it's time for a lunch break. Are you going to go get to the bar? I'm like, so this, you know, this needs to be equal. I want equality. So I needed to make it loud, and I needed to make it, you know, like scream above the band. And that's when I started experimenting with different effects and stuff like that. So I have a strong foundation in the classics. And then out of just want for being able to say something loud and proud with the band supporting me, I started changing the sound of the bass.
You're a founding member and upright bass player for the Los Angeles bass group, the West Coast Get Down, which is a collaborative group of musicians born and raised in Los Angeles. And I watched a bunch of videos of you guys playing around LA, and I think it's pretty much the coolest scene going on. In that town, there's a lot of talented people in there, and you guys seem like you're trying a lot of new things, and you have different guests come in and do stuff. Part of the mission of your group is to defy genre and combine musical influences that make jazz dangerous and exciting again. I'm wondering if you feel like you've accomplished that, and sort of how you accomplished it, and do you feel like you're drawing in younger audiences?
I think we're definitely drawing in younger audiences.
For jazz,
yeah. But I don't think that that's a terribly unique thing. I think what happens is that, or the position we're in, is that for a moment there, the legends of the genre were able to sustain their careers longer than previous generations had, just because of the way the music industry's changed. There's more opportunity for them and demand for them to continue their careers and make records and sell records, and so the torch didn't get passed as quickly. But if you look out throughout history, the old guard that, you know, they, when they were young, they reinvent the genre and they adapt to and encase and engulf all of the styles that are around them into the jazz idiom, and they advance it, and then they teach the next generation and they take over. And our generation didn't have that as smoothly of a transition, even though we were lucky enough to have a lot of those guys as our teachers. So it wasn't a selfish thing or anything like that. It was just the music industry changed. And so I think that we have accomplished the goal of bringing and making jazz exciting for our peers and our group. And that happens to be a demographic that is younger than it has been in the last 20 or 30 years, let's say. And I think it's really important because I think that jazz thrives when it is taking stock of all the new sounds around it and putting it inside of its, because it's the father of it, putting it inside of its sort of delivery system and inside of the minds of its artists. And so we are not conforming to any of the sort of museum behaviors of jazz, which it's important to have that too, because you have to know where something came from, and it benefits the audience too, but they don't have to. You know, benefits you to know about Duke Ellington and Ray Charles, but you shouldn't have to understand what's going on the stage. Mm-hmm. Four guys will step on stage and put on a great show, and you enjoy it because it's great music, not because you understand the history and the legacy of the art form.
Right.
I think we've accomplished that.
Part of what you do on your album Uprising is you sort of incorporate a bunch of things in there with jazz. There's a mix of genre represented, I would say. For instance, in Abraham, I think there's rock, soul, gospel, jazz mixed in there. And that song, also the lyrics, really stood out to me. Can you talk about who you were thinking of when you wrote that song? What inspired that song?
The inspiration for Abraham comes from me recognizing the power of my first name, which is Abraham, full name Abraham Miles Mosley. And not just my first name, but people's first names and the legacy that you carry on, each one of us, right? You are here sitting in this room with me today because generations upon generations of people woke up every day, went to work, slugged it out, good times and bad, had families, and, you know, decided that it was important to carry on. And so when I get down or I feel like, man, this is so hard, it's important to put some perspective around that, because hard in 2017 is different than hard was in 1945 or 1832. But there are some universal truths. And at the end of the day, you just have to remember not to be a jerk and not to take lightly the fact that a lot of people have come before you, and that there's power in that, and there's pride that you can take in that, and you represent those people every time you step on stage or go to work or meet somebody, and how you treat the person, you know, your fellow neighbor and the people you disagree with. Like you are representing all of that, not just you on a Tuesday. So that's lyrically where it came from. And musically, all of the influences you mentioned are in there. And it's funny, I was just at my folks' place writing my next record, and our tradition is, you know, wake up in the morning and my mom and dad put on music and make breakfast, and we sit around the table, and, you know, there's no cell phones and TVs and we are either listening to music or talking to each other about the music, about each other, about our days. We're very tight-knit, hands-on kind of family. And the playlist that morning was Gershwin, Rhapsody in Blue, Joni Mitchell, I forget what song came on, then I think Simon and Garfunkel, then Ray Charles, and then The Impressions. And that was just breakfast, you know what I mean? So that's why I sound the way I sound, because to me, that all exists. I've been listening to playlists from my parents, you know, before it was a thing. And so to me, all those styles of music are all one thing. It's just good music to listen to that makes you feel something, and generally something positive, and not something fearful or something, you know, super sad. My parents listen to music that's at least uplifting to the human spirit, and is because they're, you know, my mom's a hippie from the 60s and my father's from Alabama and in the South. And it's at least something that's acknowledging the turmoil and processing it in a way so that you get something from it. So I think that's why I sound the way I sound. You know.
Straight from the mountains of Jerusalem, I got my shield, I got my sword. Forged from Egyptian gold. I'm feared. I haven't cried in years. Sure enough, I'm scared. Mediocrity is everywhere, but not here.
I'm Allie Lightfoot, and you're tuned in to Talkin' Music. That was Miles Mosley with the song Abraham. I spoke with Miles at this year's Telluride Jazz Festival.
Another song that I wanted to talk about is Young Lion. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's about someone who just seems like he's taking off, like that feeling when you just know that you're just, nothing will hold you back. Like mm-hmm. You're that ready to go. I'm wondering what you were thinking about when you wrote that, and who's that song about?
That song is tackling the idea of ego, which is something I've spent a lot of time thinking about and what it's for. And like, did you drive here today or did you walk here?
We took the gondola.
You took the gondola. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So you got into a box that's about 4x4 attached to a string and chucked it across a mountain some hundreds of feet in the air. And probably had a very calm and pleasant conversation while you soared across, you know, mountainscapes in something that only your ego can tell you it's going to be fine and predict that you're going to end up here. Ego's not all bad. Its job is to minimize and to compartmentalize things that you do every single day. And tell you that you've got this, no problem. We can absolutely take a shower, get out, and not slip and break our head open on the corner of the sink. People do that all the time. But you still can do it because your ego says, no problem. You got somewhere to go this far away? Let's get in a car that's 4 tons and chuck it down a freeway at 80 miles an hour. And it's no problem because you've got this. You have the skill. You have the foresight. You have the ability. You can do it. So for that purpose, it's good. And it's this, that song to me is like my shot of coffee. Like, of course, there's been stuff funkier since 73. But for me to pick up a bass and try to play funk after there's been Bootsy Collins, after there's been James Brown, after there's been Larry Graham, to do that, you have to tell yourself that you can, mm-hmm. and that it's worth at least attempting, and that you have studied the greats and you have all the information you need and you know what you're up to. Otherwise, you would be paralyzed in this stasis mm-hmm. of fear. And so, yes, to prepare myself to be next and prepare myself to be a part of the next journey, I have to just say that that's my turn.
You're that good?
Yeah, exactly.
About the high side, y'all said you're going in more, but here comes roar. We'll go up in your ass for, wait for a minute, slip your hip, nod your head, push out your lips. Thank God for me, ain't nothing been funky since 73. My better is better than your better, and SB and MM stick together. Holly, Hollywood, don't need fair weather, baby, we can make it shine for free. I'm top notch, top shelf, let's see them, what else? Well, here's a kiss from the top of your playlist. Like me, a brand new hit.
heavy on the retro scene, and on full strings, baby, I'm the king. If you watch these fingers, watch these feet, under there, I got speed. Epa, epa, mama, brinca, right under my sheet. Come out the cave like a giant, you never knew I was here. I'ma take this 5-minute song to make one thing real clear. I'm rock steady, walk tall, ain't nothing wrong with the know-it-all. It ain't my fault this world's too small, someone just pass me the ball. I'm so bored, baby, look where I've become. I'm high, high, higher, so much higher. 7-3, let me run. I'm so bored, baby, look where I've become. I'm
tuned into Talkin' Music on KBNF. I'm Allie Lightfoot, and you're listening to an interview with musician Miles Mosley.
You've performed and recorded and produced and toured with artists like Kendrick Lamar, Kamasi Washington, Mos Def, India RE, Lauryn Hill, Rihanna, CeeLo Green. When I looked at that list of people, I thought that there's not a single person on that list, even if they're a pop star, that doesn't seem like they're an original. Like there's not really anybody else doing what they're doing. So since you've been hanging out with these people and working with them, what do you think it takes to be an original? What sort of in their personality or style or approach that leads to that?
That's actually a really good question. I've never been asked that before. I think I can tie a lot of those artists together with some character traits. One is obsession. Each one of them is obsessed with something or has an addictive personality pointed in the right direction, you know, that there's like there's a thirst for knowledge. Lauryn Hill has that for sure. Miss Lauryn Hill, Mos Def, got like an insatiable thirst for, like, they get into a new style of music, they want to know all about it. They all share a really short-term memory for the things that, you know, you make something and your fan base doesn't receive it the way you'd hoped. Mm-hmm. And there's a confidence that within the scope of your career, it'll make sense, even if everybody doesn't get it right this second. And I think that touches fearlessness. It touches drive. But all artists, you know, there's insecurities and, you know, we all know that you make something and you show it to someone and they don't like it. Or, I mean, heck, you buy a birthday gift for someone and they open it up lackluster. It stings because you're like, I thought for sure you were going to love that. And you get a, oh, cool, thanks. No, thanks so much. That is something you have to fight past. And to do that in art is difficult. And I think they all share an innate ability to see past that and believe in something. And I also think that there's a supreme dedication to whatever the thing is that makes them unique. Mos Def, you know, his ability to wordsmith and to craft rhythm with rhyme, he's a, like, outstanding at it. Mm-hmm. You know, Miss Lauryn Hill, I worked with her for almost a year and change, and she never sang one bad note, never flat, never sharp, never wrong. She was never wrong. She knew it too. you know, that type of knowing where your strengths are and making sure that they are way better than the average bear and continuing to pay into that is something that is really ties them all together. Rihanna is, you know, aside from her ability to really recognize a great track when she hears it, she knows a stage and she knows a camera and an angle and what performance does, which is why her videos are so fascinating and why she's so great live. And it's because she understands theater in a lot of ways, which you wouldn't attribute to it unless you saw it happen. And you see it work. You see her walk into an arena and do all the spot checks with all the spotlights before she starts. It just makes this flawless, perfect execution of a show that if that's not your strong suit, it's not as entertaining, which is why she's packing arenas around the world. So I think that ties all together too. I mean, I've learned these little things from all of the artists I've been so lucky to work with. And, you know, it's now up for me to decide which of those apply to me and which are the ones that are things that are best suited to other parts of the team. And it's a huge privilege to be able to have worked with that many awesome artists across so many different genres through so many different skill sets. And I feel really thankful for that.
So the name of the album is Uprising, and it was released in February of 2017. And if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Miles Mosley. I'm wondering what was going on when you were writing these songs and how you've seen, I guess, where politics are now or just sort of the state of the world. Do you feel like this album was even more prescient in a way?
Yeah, I think the album definitely benefits from what's happening in the world today. When I was writing the album, it was a different landscape, in America at least. And I don't consider politics at the center of my art. Politics is the thing that humans do to try to figure out a way to get all these billions of people to coexist. But I believe that the human condition is something that we all grapple with. And I believe that there are universal truths and common struggles that we can all relate to. And for me, this collection of songs touches those different topics and frames them differently, hopefully so that if anybody was feeling the way I was feeling during whichever song you're listening to, it provides an assistance. But it's not higher than you. It's going down to wherever your emotional level is. And if you need a pick-me-up, it's there to pick you up. If you need someone to just come over with a bottle of vodka, order pizza, and, you know, watch beaches or something with you, it'll do that. So it's music that's, I think, serves a purpose. And that's, I think there's a space for that in music. And music serves a lot of different purposes. And they all don't have to tick each box. I've been at this for a long time, at least under the timeline of what a music career is. And I've had to learn a lot about patience and rejection and fortitude and all these different really broad stroke life lessons to see how learning something like the upright bass and getting to a skill level and having promises, you know, given to you from teachers and from clubs and promoters and, you know, all the things that say, well, just do this and then that and you'll get the thing. Well, having that not arrive at the time I want it to arrive is how a song like, you know, More Than This comes, or Ellie Won't Bring You Down. And the fact of the matter is there is more time than you feel there is, and that however this spotlight is moving, if you believe in fate and, you know, or God or Zeus or whatever, I think they all kind of let you know that this is, your life is going to unfold as it's sort of predestined and planned. And I subscribe to that. So I think that these songs provide some framework to what happens along the way while fate is doing the driving, you know.
Sight. Pandora's pandemic, box of lies, sunk my ship before.
remorse, caught before the horse. Digging graves, he says, are for trees. But nothing is dead, it's all in his head. Mistook reality for poetry. Maybe it's me, I spook easy if the doors ain't locked. A promise is a promise till it's conveniently not. Fumble some trust, as a human you must. But watch those lies, watch those lies.